Somebody, well, we used to call, they were known as the Crab Fat outfit. The color of their uniform was Crab Fat, which was the gray, the gray grease you put on guns. The sailors always called that Crab Fat, so they named the uniform Crab. When the Crab Fat, you know, they don't know nothing. I want sailors in airplanes, always will have. That was the, we were deposited in Singapore, and on my way home to England to qualify as a sub-lieutenant, I was stopped at Colombo and sent to a cruiser called Exeter. But that's another story.
So you got cleaned up. I mean, you've been fished out of the water, or you fished yourself out of the water, is more appropriate. You were shipped out of Singapore.
Well, the survivors, we were all put in. Some went off to fight in Malaya, in the riverine craft.
Mm-hmm.
I was due, as the other mids were, due to go back to England to do, be promoted to sub-lieutenant and be sent off to do some courses in England. And
went up to Ceylon, or now Sri Lanka.
Yeah, we went to Ceylon, to Colombo, and there a cruiser came in called Exeter. I had 2 weeks leave, went up with this friend of mine, David Room, whose father was engineer in chief of the Indian Army, and was up in at the headquarters in Karachi. No, I guess up in, not Karachi, up in Delhi. And they gave us 10-day survivor's leave, he said, come on up to my people in northern India. So we went up there for 10 days holiday. I had a good time living like a Pakasab. And then I was ordered, we were to return, both of us, to catch the ship to go back to England in, an empty troop ship. Got down there, and this cruiser hove in called Exeter. And they had had a lot of dysentery or something. This was their excuse. Anyway, they were short-handed. And four of us were detailed to join her. He had the left turn. And we said, I'm supposed to be a sub-lieutenant, supposed to go back to England and get promoted. They said, okay, you can be a sub-lieutenant. You can be an acting sub-lieutenant, but you're not going to England. So I clued up in this in the 8-inch cruiser, Exeter, and straight back into the war zone, and 3 months later went March. What was this? December? March. Swimming again. They sunk us in the South Java Sea. Another big ship.
Don't you get a little worried that maybe you were a jinx, I mean, Harry?
Switch that off for a second.
Just turn this back on now.
When I joined Exeter, I had to. We went straight back into action, and of course, by that time, the Pacific was collapsing in all directions. Japanese were mustering a force to invade Java. We were doing a lot of anti-aircraft. We had quite a good anti-aircraft set in that ship, taking convoys in and out of Singapore, mostly, first of all, in. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon out, because this was Christmas of 1941. Christmas, January, Hong Kong had fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, the whole of the Pacific was collapsing. The Philippines were... Philippines was being attacked, and was about, Corregidor was surrounded. And the Japs were heading for Australia. The only thing that stood between them and Australia was this remnants of the Asiatic fleet to... American cruisers, three Australian cruisers, two Dutch cruisers, and two British cruisers, of which Exeter was one. They threw them all together into the most ragtag bobtailed cruiser squadron with three different languages.
Who'd be commanding?
And by a Dutch admiral, no less.
A
called
Dutch
Dorman, Army. Yeah, who had never fought nothing nowhere. And this is why things have changed a lot since we invented NATO. So we went into action against the Japanese cruiser force on the 1st of March, covering a convoy. We
on
saw
your,
that
you were on your way to Australia. Is this
no? We were operating out of the island of Java, what is now called what is called Batavia, now called Jakarta. And it was there that we were operating at the naval base under Dutch support against the Japanese. And we sailed, the whole lot of us, into a complete debacle. We ran into a huge cruiser squadron, and nobody could coordinate the fire. It was another lovely afternoon. There's a painting there of it, the second picture down. Beautiful flat day, just like this again. The last of the A to K lines, two lines of cruisers, you know, lined up, and we started shooting, just one, you know, exchanging fire. Beautiful pattern, straight out of the drill book, you know, with the destroyers, some 32 to 38 destroyers in the two forces, about evenly matched. And the destroyers hiding behind the cruisers in the proper way, and then each cruiser taking its opposite number in the line, and no airplanes or anything unfair like that, no submarines, just a genuine last...
Right out of the book.
Right out of the book. Then the the destroyers attack through the cruiser screen,
mm-hmm.
going between us, marvelous sight. You know, 38 knots, black smoke, all their torpedoes trained outboard. Dutch, British, and Australian.
Now, did you have any doubts now at this point? Now, you're no longer... The Prince of Wales is gone?
Gone, yeah. This is the only force between the Japs in the Western Pacific and Australia.
You know, I know, but I guess what I'm getting at is you yourself, no, you're not so, feeling invincible?
Well, no, I'm feeling a bit nervous. No, not nervous. Actually, I wasn't nervous at all. I just thought part of the business. No,
apprehensive?
No, not apprehensive, because one had a great deal of faith in the guys who were running the show. Once I went, didn't realize, of course, the size of the Japanese force. It's another thing. It was no intelligence. This covering force of the Japs that we've met, made up of 4 8-inch and about four 8-inch and 4 6-inch cruisers, total of 8. But their 8-inch cruisers had, you know, 10 8-inch, the Ashigara class. They were young battleships, bloody great things. We were the heaviest gun, the only 8-inch ship in the... No, the Perth, the Houston, the American, were 2 8-inch ships, the Houston and the Exeter. The rest were all little 6-inch jobs. Nevertheless, the whole thing was operated as like Dorman, straight out of the Jutland, you know. No, I didn't feel any... in the final, we knew really... The final action, one just felt angry. But in this action, it was just a big deal. It looked fine. We thought we were going to win that one. You always think you're going to win it. These destroyers went through the line, and the opposition destroyers went through their line, and they met in the middle. Again, I had a ringside seat, because I was the HA control officer, high up in the...
High
above in the Exeter, the same sort of configuration. And this time I was doing some shooting, because I could see it all, because we were close enough for 4-inch gunfire. Those destroyers, and you couldn't shoot at them anyway, they went past each other, you know, at a speed of 60 knots, 30 each direction like that, shooting at each other, and they each side fired all their fish into the other line of cruisers, and each column of cruisers turned away as if by signal, showing your stern to the torpedo, and there were no hits. There were no hits. Not a one. In the middle, there were a few destroyers got hit gunfire in the milieu in the middle, but you've never, I don't think, that there's been a sight like that. You had around, I think it's 32, it may have been 38 destroyers, mixing it up between two columns of cruisers, all going, flat out, all with belching black smoke, all with their guns blazing. It was straight out of a movie. But about as effective as a third wheel on a bicycle, you know. So this went on all afternoon. As the cruiser squadron turned away, we turned away, the second cruiser in the column of Japanese, who was our target, fired her after turret, a pair of turrets, and the 8 inches at maximum range dropped right into our boiler room. Poof! 4 of them. And took out took all the steam and took 4 of the 8 boilers with it and damaged some of our 4-inch guns. Mine again. My 4-inch battery. One mm-hmm. wiped right off. And we lost steam and lost control. And we pulled out of line, which you're supposed to do. But nobody could speak each other's language. It's no good getting on the light because the Dutch Navy and the British Navy had no common code. So, we tried to use, and there was no radio between ships. It was all done by flags. And, of course, the column behind us, of all the other Allied cruisers, thought that in the smoke and everything, that they were following each other. And we turned away like that, and the whole column turned behind us and left the flagship, the De Ruyter, steaming on by himself towards the enemy, with the rest of his column gone off. This is an action, you see. Now, you could laugh about this, but this is what happens when you put, you know, a lot of nations together in a hurry, saying, here, get out and fight. You can't do that. That's why NATO is so necessary. We came to a stop, and eventually the other cruisers realized what the trouble was and fell in behind the flagship, and the battle moved off and left us behind. The battle battle gradually wore the Allied squadron down all that night. The Japanese launched these absolutely fabulous saber torpedoes, which nobody knew they had. With their excellent night vision, they put in a torpedo attack and sank both of the Dutch cruisers and the American and the Australian cruiser were caught the next day in the straits and sunk. But we were left behind in this battle late in the afternoon. A couple of British destroyers peeled off and laid a smoke screen around us and said farewell. And we couldn't see out, no radar. We had the aerial warning radar, but nothing you could see through this smoke screen. We were busy mending our boilers, trying to get ourselves going again, because we lost all our steam.
Mm-hmm.
When all of a sudden, over the top of the... We had our guns ready, 8-inch guns ready. We were actually range-taking on the inside of the smoke screen, so we knew exactly what the range was. The skipper, or somebody, saw the battle tops of a ship coming through the smoke. And as it emerged, he opened fire on it, and it was a Japanese light cruiser at point-blank range. We had no steam. We were sitting still. We had all the steam he could muster was in the electrical, in the turbines, in the generators,
mm-hmm.
Because the guns were electrically worked. It was just enough power. So everything in the ship was switched off except the guns. We waited. And sure enough, these two cruisers came through, little light jobs, little light 6-inch ones. First one came through, and he got us direct... two broadsides in him, and he blew up literally a stone's throw from us. It's a marvelous sight. And his winger, coming in behind him, broke out of the smoke screen at an oblique angle further down. We took a crack at him, hit him, and he disappeared. He didn't sink. And there we were, left, in the middle of the Java Sea. We patched up ourselves and staggered back to the naval base at the other end of Java called Surabaya, which is a Dutch naval base down there. And there we sat, the survivors of the last of the Asiatic fleet. We had only 14 knots and less than a quarter of our ammunition left, and two destroyers, one American and one British, with no torpedoes. And that was the remnant of the Southeast Asia fleet.
You couldn't physically get down to Australia at all? Or
well, we were ordered out to attack the convoy. On an open line telephone from a headquarters that was sitting beside an airplane up in the interior, and the whole lot, the admiral, whose name shall be nameless, who had been in Malaya.
That's not fair. You got three names now.
Just a minute. He's had a double barrel name. Had flown out. He'd commanded it to Singapore, evacuated to Java, and then from Java he went to Colombo. And he left orders that this force, you know, us, was to go out and re-tack the convoy. And nobody questioned that at all. And we sailed in the middle of the night, in a moonlight night, with these two destroyers.
With no
torpedoes. And to seek out the convoy was the last order. This convoy coming in to make a landing on Java. And you can say what you like, but the skipper said, that's what I do. So we sailed. At night we could see landing craft coming across the moon, going into Java as we were coming out. And we thought we had got clear, and we were going to make a run up and then go out through between Java and Sumatra and go to Colombo. We were going to take a crack at the convoy if we met it. Instead of that, at 7:30 in the morning, we ran into a force of four cruisers.
Four.
Same fellows as that had chopped up we'd been fighting 3 days before. And the fun started at about 8, and they reduced the ship to a flaming wreck by 11:30, all with gunfire, 8-inch. And then they torpedoed her, and we rolled over and sank. And I cleared the quarterdeck, having come down from the upper. When I told abandoned ship, she was on forward, both turrets, one smashed right over the side. It was just like a red-hot stove. She was burning from both ends. That's a very good picture of her up there. Nobody ever found out what happened to us. We disappeared, along with the two destroyers. Both of them were sunk. And
sent to your family at home?
Yeah. There was no report from... No, not quite. There were some survivors picked up. I was separated. There was 110 or 12, 112 of us who were separated and were picked up by a Japanese destroyer force. Now, they had never picked up survivors before, and they never did it again. But they came by and they hauled us out of the water. I'd been in the water about 32 hours by the time they came by, and were feeling pretty well dead. No sharks in one of the most shark-infested pieces of water in the world. Don't ask me why. They treated us excellently while we were in their ships, and then we were landed separately in a little town of Makassar on what is now called Salawin. It used to be the Celebes. And they weren't interested. We were taken over by a Japanese army unit as prisoners and belted around a lot. And they had no, they simply weren't going to report us at all. We said, what about my name, number, and where's my Red Cross package? And they just said, drop dead, which we nearly did. As a result, nobody heard about, some survivors names eventually came through. But that dried up, and they took it for granted that everybody else was dead. Nobody knew what happened to the ship, because one of the early salvos in that final action carried away all our radio equipment. And so I disappeared and was 3.5 years dead. And that's what they sent my mother.
They sent your mother to the next of kin. You're a midshipman in the Royal Canadian Navy. This is to commemorate the gratitude of the government and the people of Canada for the life of a brave man, freely given in the service of his country. His name will ever be held in proud remembrance. Signed by the Minister of National Defense for Naval Services.
A well-known politician.
Yes.
And
how can they call his signature?
That's MacDonald. He was a well-known politician.
Mm.
And that arrived home, you see.
And a small purple, I don't know.
And the Memorial Cross.
Memorial
and
purple.
That my mother received in the end of 1942, and everybody said that's the end of him, and except my parents, who said no, he's not, and they didn't collect any insurance. Insurance company wanted to collect because I had a small insurance policy, and father said no, and I couldn't. We never saw a Red Cross person. We never wrote a letter. We never for 3.5 years of nothing, and then one day when I came out, I sent a wire, not knowing that nobody knew. I don't know why I didn't know. It was kind of a stupid thing. I just sent a telegram out of the blue from Calcutta saying, stand back, here I come. That's all I said. Just sort of dumb thing, you say, you know. I said, stand back, I'm coming on leave. Signed, Dick. And this arrived in Penticton, and everybody said, you know, Dick who? And my mother said, that's him. And my father said, maybe. And everybody else said, not likely. And I, dumb enough, I didn't do anything else. I just said, I'm coming home. I don't know why you're so dumb. I didn't realize that I'd been dead. I didn't realize that nobody knew I had gone. The war is so big, one didn't know these things. And it was quite some time before I got around to sending another telegram. And it was days and days in Penticton with nothing else out of the blue. Until I sort of I was put into a hospital and cleaned up. I weighed a little under 100 pounds, and flew hitchhiked with another Canadian right across the southeast into England, and then across in an aircraft carrier with Mr. As I stepped into Mr. Gieves, arrived in London, no hair, the colour of that desk, burnt brown in the sun from working, 12 hours a day for 3.5 years, and Mr. Gieves said, ah! Mr. Lear, glad to have you back, sir, without batting an eyelid. I said, I want a lieutenant's uniform. I think I ought to be a lieutenant. And he said, yes, sir. And 3 days later, I was back in uniform. Skinny as a rake and drinking like a fish. Hadn't eaten a square meal for 3.5 years. was given command, you know, because I was a straight stripe lieutenant. They said, here, take this 100 men back on this carrier to, everybody was being taken, you know, rehabilitation, being taken back to Canada, finishing big draft. So I said, yes, sir, and didn't tell anybody who I was. Nobody asked. Until I arrived in Halifax in November, and then I dropped, I was standing in the upper deck, entering harbour, with all these seamen, ranged as a division, you know, for entering harbour, and I just collapsed, pow. And they picked me up and put me in the hospital, and when I came around, they said, hey, who are you? And I said, my name's Lear. And they said, well, where's your ID card? I said, I haven't got one. Where have you been? I said, I've been in the Jap prisoner of war. And they said, nonsense, you're out of your mind. And I said, well, fine. Would you? They said, they inspected me and found I had all sorts of things like hookworm and dysentery and dengue fever and God knows what. And they said, yes, we better clean you up. And they did a tremendous job. They put me on puried vegetables for 5 times a day and nothing else. Mm. And said, stay there. And a month later, I was released. And when I was sent for by Ottawa, and they said, well, where have you been? And I said, I've been here, and I'll have 3.5 years back pay, if you don't mind. About then, the music went off. it was that way. And then, but it wasn't until I think I reached England that I actually sent a coherent telegram to my parents saying, you know, I'm there and I'm expecting to be back in Canada. And that's when they realized I was alive. And so, you know, the only people who complained was the Treasury Board, I guess. I got $11,000 in back pay, which was an immense sum in 1946 for a lieutenant. That's a brief story. I think that's enough for the day.
Very good. Thank you very much, sir.